7 p.m. Monday to Friday. Clear Spot on Resonance 104.4 FM. Each weekday evening, Resonance invites a different artist to redefine radio for the 21st century. Resonance FM 104.4. The Art of Listening.
This is Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is The Clear Spot.
This is the Clear Spot on Resonance FM. My name's Phil England, and for the next hour and a half, we'll be looking at the subject of climate change. In deciding to do this programme, my contention was that although the scientific community had now reached consensus on many of the basic facts about climate change, a lot of people were still unclear about whether global warming was actually happening, and if it was, whether it was something to be concerned about. Only this week in The Guardian's letter page, the director of the free market think tank, the Adam Smith Institute, compared global warming to frostbite and claimed that evidence for whether human-induced global warming even exists is about as dodgy as the average Downing Street dossier. So, to find out what the world's leading scientists have concluded about climate change, we went to the top, to the most authoritative organisation on the state of the science, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC for short. I spoke to David Griggs, who, besides being the director of the Hadley Centre, which is the UK Meteorological Office's Centre for Climate Prediction and Research, also has an ongoing role in the IPCC process.
It seems to me that there seems to be some measure of confusion about climate change amongst the population at large. If people wanted to find out the answers, why should they trust the IPCC?
Well, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is an organisation that was set up by the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations Environment Programme. So it's part of the United Nations sort of body of organisations.
Right.
To provide the best scientific advice on climate change. It's not advocating policy. It's not telling people what they should or should not do. It's there to get the world's best scientists together, many hundreds of them, to write reports which are balanced, objective, which are relevant to policy, and inform people who have to make policy, but are completely policy neutral. In other words, they focus purely on the science and on what the latest scientific findings and consensus is.
Right. So it doesn't conduct new research as such. It actually collects what's known and reviews that and tries to build a consensus.
That's right. It doesn't. It draws on research which has already been done throughout the world community. It doesn't do research of its own. It doesn't try and force consensus where there isn't consensus. If there is a genuine difference of opinion within the scientific community, then it reflects that difference of scientific opinion. Where there is a broad consensus, it reflects that broad consensus. So it's to try and state, you know, the current state of our knowledge and understanding of climate change.
Right. So over the last 15 years, the IPCC has issued 3 assessment reports. From the observational data that's been collected about the Earth's climate over the last century, were you able to confirm that the Earth has been warming over that period?
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Over the last 100 years, the Earth has warmed by about 0.6 degrees Celsius. The evidence for that is completely widespread. It's mainly from the observations that are taken around the world, but there are also many other ways of backing that up. Mountain glaciers have retreated, Arctic sea ice has thinned and retreated, lakes and rivers melt later and melt earlier and freeze later. There's a whole sort of consensus of information from around the world that the global climate has changed over the last 100 years and has got warmer.
Right.
That doesn't say what's caused it.
Right.
What it says is it's got warmer.
Okay. So is there evidence that this is could be perhaps part of the normal fluctuations or cycles of the Earth's weather systems, or is it the result of human intervention?
Well, that's what the world scientists are working their very hardest to try and work out. Because the climate system does vary. It varies day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year, because of the, you know, the changes that go on within the atmosphere and the oceans. Whether the changes that we have seen are due to human influence, you have to look at the range of that sort of normal variability and the factors which are possibly causing the current warming. And to cut a very long story short, the consensus view is that most of the warming that we've seen over the last 50 years is due to human influence. And that's really only we've only been able to say that with any degree of confidence over the last few years, as the sort of signal of the sort of man-made climate change has emerged out of the sort of noise of natural variability.
So you talked about an increase of 0.6 degrees over the last century. It might not sound like a lot, but how significant is that?
Well, it's significant. It's not life-threatening. We're still here 100 years later, having experienced a 0.6 degrees C warming. But to give you an idea of the kind of scale we're talking about, the difference in global temperature today from the difference in global temperature during the middle of the last ice age is about 6 degrees. So we've already seen something around about one-tenth of that over the last 100 years. And, of course, what we're predicting over the next 100 years is even more than that.
And already there are some quite a lot of effects that have been observed of this as a result of this warming. Perhaps you could briefly outline some of those.
So as I said before, the mountain glaciers have retreated widespread around the world. Lake and river ice is melting earlier, freezing later. Birds and plants are moving their territory and habitat to adjust to changes in the climate. Here in the UK, the spring has been coming earlier and earlier, and those kinds of changes have been reflected right around the world.
The polar caps also have been retreating to some extent.
That's right. The polar ice caps, the North Polar ice cap has been retreating and thinning. And some of the predictions for the next century, if we continue to emit a lot of greenhouse gases, are that the Arctic ice could disappear completely in around that sort of late autumn, late summer, early autumn, by the end of this century. It would reappear again during the winter as it gets colder again. But at the end of the sort of summer period, at the end of the warmest period, the Arctic sea ice may have disappeared altogether.
Right. And that in turn contributes to a rise in sea levels.
The melting of the ice obviously contributes to a sea level rise, yes, but it's not the biggest factor in sea level rise. The biggest factor in sea level rise is just the thermal expansion of the water.
Right.
The water gets warmer, it expands.
Right.
And that's the biggest factor. And then the second biggest factor is the melting of ice, yes.
And observationally, has there also been an increase in extreme weather events over the last century?
That's much harder to tell. There is some evidence that some extreme weather events have changed, but they're actually very hard to observe. We haven't really got very many observations of extreme weather events, in the early parts of this century. So it's actually much more difficult to tell. Clearly, we've had much more extreme warm weather events, heat waves, droughts, etc. There is growing evidence that we're seeing an increased incidence of flooding in the winters as the winters get milder and wetter. So it's not as clear as for the sort of broad picture of a global warming. But yes, there is some evidence, growing evidence, that there are changes in extreme events happening.
Right. So there's a lot of modelling going on to try and predict what might happen over the next century. I understand that's kind of a large part of what climate change scientists are involved in these days. What are the predictions currently, or the range of predictions about the possible rise in temperature over the next century?
Okay, well, the reason we use models is they're the only tool that you can use for predicting future climate. The climate system is just too complicated to just carry on trends that we're seeing or to make simple statistical sort of analysis. So big, complex computer models of the Earth system are the only tool that we have. And when we use those tools, they're some of the most sophisticated computer programs in the world, we predict that over the next century, the warming will be in the range of 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius. That depends on, the reason we have such a wide range is really two things. One, it depends on how much fossil fuel we burn and hence how much greenhouse gas we put into the atmosphere. And also, because these models are not perfect and there are still uncertainties in them.
So that's quite significantly more than what we've experienced in the current the 20th century. What are the effects that will accompany those changes in temperature?
Even the smallest of those changes is a rate of change, a rate of increase of temperature that is unprecedented in at least the last 10,000 years, as far back as we can, as far back as we can look.
Where are you getting that? Where does that data come from?
It comes from what we call proxy data or paleo data. We have observations going back about 140 years from thermometers, etc. But you can actually go back and look at the width of tree rings. You can get information on temperature from ice cores and corals and ocean sediments. And so by using those to determine what the temperature was, back into history, we can make those kind of statements.
And you were saying that even the smallest of those temperature increases will have quite some effect.
Yes, I mean, we don't fully understand what the effects could be because the climate system is a very complicated place with, things can happen and flip from one sort of state to another. So we're not quite completely clear as to what the impacts would be, but we can certainly expect to see a continuation of the trends, of the impacts that we have seen, more hot weather, more heat waves, more droughts, more flooding in the winters, more severe weather events, more loss of habitat and species. But the worst implications are really for the developing countries because they don't have the capacity to adapt to their changing climate. A lot of their agriculture is barely sustainable in today's climate. A small increase in temperature simply makes it completely unsustainable.
So a wide range of impacts, really, then?
Yes, a wide range of impacts. As I say, falling primarily on the developing countries. A country like the UK has the wherewithal to adapt to some of its climate change. If the sea level rises, you can either retreat from the coast or you can build sea defences. If you're in Bangladesh, then you can't really do that.
Right. So we're much more likely to be able to cope in industrialised countries with the effects of climate change.
Yes, although the economic impacts will be significant.
Mm. And more extreme weather events are likely?
Yes. Again, it's one of those areas we're not so certain about. But we can expect to see an increased frequency of storminess, perhaps an increased intensity of those storms, which would lead to increases in flooding and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I understand also from the last assessment report that even if we were to stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow and thereby stopping the rate of increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the global mean temperature would still continue to rise.
That's right. I mean, these gases hang around in the atmosphere for quite a long time. Carbon dioxide, the main sort of greenhouse gas, has a lifetime in the atmosphere of around about 100 years. So we're already going to see over the coming decades some warming from the carbon dioxide we've already emitted. So yes, the temperature, even if we reduce the emissions very rapidly today, which of course is not really practical to do, but even if you could do that, then we would expect the world's temperature to continue to rise for 100 years or more, and sea level to rise for 1,000 years or more, because there's a very, the oceans store an awful lot of the heat and the energy that is going into them at the moment, and that would gradually be released over a period. But the earlier that you do cut those emissions, the sort of better for the climate system it is, because you're saving again 100 years worth of warming for everything that you stop emitting today.
Yeah. Are there dangers of positive feedbacks as well in the climate change system that maybe we don't have the full information about the potential impact of
Yes, certainly. As I said, the world's climate system is a very complicated place. You know, there's the atmosphere, the oceans, the land, the ice, and all the interactions that take place between them mean that we're a very long way from fully understanding all these interactions. And sometimes, you know, you can get funny interactions which can cause things to sort of flip from one state to the other. One of the popular ones is the thermohaline circulation. That's the warm water, the Gulf Stream, that brings a lot of the sort of mild winter weather to the UK. We know from distant history that that can turn off. And some of the models suggest that if we continue to go, you know, along the global warming route, then, you know, the thermohaline circulation could switch off. We don't know if that's right. We don't know if it's right when it would happen, or, you know, what would cause it to happen. But it's a possibility, and there are other possibilities. So, yes, the climate system is a very complex and not fully understood place. And, you know, by sort of forcing it with global warming and greenhouse gases, we are, you know, taking ourselves into a very uncertain future.
In summary, then, there is broad consensus amongst the scientific community that the Earth has warmed about 0.6 degrees centigrade over the last century, and that most of the warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. The results of this warming have already been dramatic, with widespread retreat of mountain glaciers and the polar ice, and changes in seasonal cycles. Though it might seem desirable to be experiencing Mediterranean temperatures in southern England, it's not that simple. In the UK, as well as higher temperature extremes, we can expect to see wetter winters, more intense rainfall events, flooding and rises in sea level. Agriculture will be affected, since although the length of the growing season will increase, summer soil moisture will decrease. Climate change is expected to impact on almost every area of human activity, including our water resources, food security, forestry, fisheries, energy, industry, insurance and health. But while we're relatively well placed to adapt to these changes, in Europe and America, for example, at least in the short term, it's the world's poor majority that will suffer most from climate change. And the IPCC predicts that it will be in the developing world where loss of life will be the greatest. Shortly, we're going to hear from author Mark Linus, who has been travelling the globe to see firsthand some of the impact on local communities. But first, we're going to take a short musical break.
Bomba makambwe, eh, eh. Bomba makambwe, eh, eh. maele soki oyokini kambo zala na maele tango bakotuna yo bandeko
omba makambo omba makambo
obimi yo na moninga bandeko bosali ndoki bombaka na motema o ekoluka matata bandeko
omba makambo omba makambo
okei mboka ya bato okuti likambo soki ozongi bandeko bombaka na motema bandeko
omba makambo omba makambo
Songi, bikumba kumba, bimema mema, bikundola kundola, bikamboba kundaki, yo peko kundola. Ah, soki okinanda kwa moninga, soko kineko lia, lia, soko kineko senga, senga, soko kineko zangi, vanda, tala, tika kumba makambo yanga. Ibune
yegabo
Songi songi bandeko
Omba makambo Omba makambo
Zala na maele Soki oyokini kambo Zala na maele Tango kofunda moninga bandeko
Omba makambo
That was Franco from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Zaire as it was then, from 1972 with Lakambo ya Ngana. You're listening to Clear Spot on Resonance 104.4 FM and we're looking at climate change. We'll be speaking to another scientist from the Hadley Centre later on in the programme. But first, to illustrate some of the impacts that climate change is already having on communities around the world, I spoke to Mark Linus, author of a forthcoming book called High Tide, News from a Warming World, which will be published by Flamingo Press in March 2004.
Yeah, you've got this book coming out in, is it early next year?
Yeah, March 2004.
Okay, and perhaps you could outline the scope of the book and which kind of countries you visited to research for it?
Well, the starting point for the book, which was a conclusion I arrived at a couple of years ago, was simply that the debate about whether or not climate change is a reality is over. It's not really a point of argument anymore. Climate change is happening, we know it's happening, and I can go out there and around the world and prove that it's happening by visiting the places where the impacts of climate change are most visible. And in the course of doing that, I went to five continents and many, many different countries to see different kinds of impacts in different kinds of places. So, for example, I went to Peru, into the highest part of the Peruvian Andes, to look at how the glaciers were disappearing there because of rising temperatures and the effect that has on water supplies. I also went to Alaska, where I could see that the permafrost underground was melting and how buildings were collapsing and roads were being turned sort of ups and into lots of different waves just because of the way that was. I also went to China, where droughts displacing people from huge areas of the north of the country, and to a Pacific island called Tuvalu, which you may have heard of, which is being evacuated currently because of rising sea levels. So I wanted to show really the whole panoply really of different impacts that climate change is causing right now, and really give some indication of how severe this is going to get in the future. And the answer to that is very severe indeed.
You say you went to Peru. The impact is the melting glaciers there. That's...
Yeah, in Peru, I have a history with Peru personally. I used to live there when I was between 5 and 8 years old, when I was just a kid. I went to school there. My father was working as a geologist in the highest part of the Andes there. And during the course of his geological mapping work, he took pictures of the glaciers as they were then. And it occurred to me that if I went back about 20, you know, with now, which is 22 years later, then I would be able to see from my own family pictures, really, whether the glaciers were melting as people were saying they were. And so I did this. I went right back, you know, it was a 2 or 3 days hard trekking to get to some of the places because they were very remote, and also I got quite severe altitude sickness, so it was actually quite an escapade to do this. But I went back and I found that in some cases the glaciers had actually disappeared altogether, which was really quite shocking. I hadn't expected that. And I wanted to outline the human impacts of this. It's not just a case of it's a shame that the glacier is gone, but actually that they have an effect, because most of the population in Peru lives on the coast, which is one of the driest deserts in the world, the Atacama Desert. Lima, specifically the capital, 7 million people or so, and that's the biggest desert, second biggest desert city after Cairo and the whole of the world. And all of the water comes down from the mountains via these rivers which flow into the Pacific, and all of this water in the dry season comes from melting glaciers. So once the glaciers have disappeared, the rivers will disappear too. And what's going to happen to the coastal population of Peru, which is many, many millions of people? How will they survive is simply the question. And it's very clear this is going to happen and start happening really, and it's beginning to happen now, but it's going to happen much, much worse in 20 to 30 to 40 years or so. People are simply not going to be able to exist. And the same is the case in the Indian subcontinent, where all the major rivers that come down from the Himalayas, the Indus, Brahmaputra, and the Ganges, all also depend on glacial melt to keep running all year round. And that's not just a few million people, that's a billion people who survive on them. So again, there's enormous questions of how the warming of the planet because of climate change is going to affect people's lives. Really, the vast majority of humanity will be impacted in some way or another, and the consequences will get increasingly severe unless something's done to stop greenhouse gas emissions right now.
So in Peru, the effects on the local community, that's actually happening, people are actually finding it, experiencing changes in their lives right now.
In Peru, people are really noticing it. Local people are really noticing how the glaciers have disappeared. I went to a religious ceremony that they do near Cusco, which is the old Inca capital in Peru, a place famous on many tourist itineraries. And up in the mountains there, there's a little-known sort of Inca-Catholic festival which happens every year, where people go up to the glaciers in the high mountains there, because they believe that the mountain spirits, which they call Apus, live there, and they believe that the mountain spirits have power. And they go up there and they actually climb up onto the glaciers and they take ice down and they basically worship these spirits. And again, people have been doing this for 2 or 3 decades. Some people I met there who'd been going for 20 or 30 years, and they could show me directly where the glacier was when they came and how far away it is now. And these glaciers have really only got a few decades to survive as well. And people, they're just in a cultural sense, they're saying, well, the mountain spirits are disappearing, the mountain spirits are leaving us. We don't think this is going to bode well for our future.
Eventually it will cause a problem with the rivers, and they'll become seasonal, is that correct?
Yeah, there's two distinct seasons in Peru, a wet season and a dry season. Because it's so close to the equator, it doesn't really have winter and summer in that sense. So rivers flow during the wet season because it's raining, obviously. In the dry season, the water flow has to come from melting ice, which is on the highest part of the mountains. That's what keeps the rivers flowing. So once the ice is gone, rivers will only flow when it rains during the wet season. So for 6 months of the year, the rivers will be dried up. And that's the big question, really, hanging over the whole of Peru's future, is how the coastal fringe, which is where most people live, which is a desert, can survive without the rivers running. And the water authorities in Lima, the capital, are beginning to wake up to this, and they're desperate to look for solutions, really, from building dams, which has many of its own problems, especially in an earthquake-prone area such as Peru, to desalinating water from the sea using petrol-driven generators. But again, I mean, it's ice. The mountains are like ice towers in the sky. They're huge reservoirs of frozen fresh water, and it's provided by nature, and so humans will have to find some other way to provide this water if it disappears.
And this is happening on a global scale. Glaciers are withdrawing, receding, with as global warming kind of kicks in aggressively. And you also were saying that therefore there's a major impact on the people living in near the three major rivers in India. So there's a huge population there that are under threat.
Yeah. Glaciers are retreating across the whole of the world increasingly rapidly. The rate of retreat has doubled really within the last 20 years. They've been retreating now for about a century. Global warming's really only took off after about 1960 or so, and that's really when you see the major changes beginning to happen. So every mountain range in the world, from the Himalayas to the Andes to the Alaska mountains, the glaciers there are retreating increasingly quickly, and all of this water is going into the sea, of course, which is raising sea levels increasingly quickly as well. And glaciers have enormous value as reservoirs of water for people who live on the rivers that come down from them, especially in drier parts of the world, where really 70 or 80 or even 90% of the water that you get comes from rivers which come down from the mountains. And a particular case of this is in the Indian subcontinent, where the Ganges, the Brahmaputra and the Indus River, which water basically the entire subcontinent, come down from the Himalayas. They come down from the ice fields, which is it's some of the largest ice fields outside the poles, really, on the Himalayas, which are also increasingly affected by climate change. These ice fields are disappearing, and the rivers will flow less and less outside the monsoon season, and that will endanger the survival of up to 1.5 billion people over the next 50 years.
Okay. You also mentioned China and there's the possibility that they might be increasingly affected by drought.
China is being affected by drought right now. When I visited last year, it was in the middle of the worst drought that they've experienced this entire century. And this, what really struck me was that how little people knew about this. It's not something which is well publicised at all. And I saw personally whole villages which have been abandoned, houses covered in sand dunes. Really, the whole area is turning to desert and blowing away. I experienced two major sandstorms, dust storms, where the sun was blotted out and became as dark as night, and you couldn't breathe, really. We had to retreat into a hut. And this is really symptomatic of the way that climate change is affecting that area. It's flooding more in the south of China. It's got much drier in the north of China. These kinds of disparities are part of the way that global warming affects the Earth's hydrological system. And the Yellow River, for example, has really ceased to reach the sea for 300 days a year now. It doesn't flow any longer. And it is particularly complicated to try and figure out what is global warming impact and what is direct impact of overgrazing, overpopulation, industrialization, this kind of stuff. So it really isn't easy to tease apart the different strands of this. But it was pretty clear to me that by speaking to scientists and speaking to local people, that simply the rainfall had been decreasing. And that, speaking to scientists, it did seem that this was quite likely to be a current impact of climate change.
Is there much research happening in China? I mean, in the UK, for example, there's a government programme to study the impacts of climate change on the UK, but is there any kind of programme?
Yeah, the UK
equivalent programme in China, for example.
The UK is suffering almost the reverse problem from China, which is that the UK gets more severe flooding in the winter, and that's quite scientifically justifiable, and I actually did a lot of research on that and wrote a chapter about it, really to bring it closer to home to people, that it wasn't something which was simply going to affect third world populations in distant countries. But to go back to China itself, there are huge scientific programs there. It's quite difficult to to figure out what's going on, because it's all in Chinese and not very many people there speak English, and certainly all the scientific publications are not translated either, so it's quite difficult to get to the bottom of that. But the scientists who I did meet were very concerned that global warming was causing, or at least had some role in causing the current drought, and that this situation was likely to get worse as temperatures carried on rising, because what happens is as the temperature rises, the rate of evaporation rises. So even if the rainfall stays the same, with more water evaporating from the ground or from plants, it actually gets that much drier. And so looking into the future, the rainfall may not change much, but if the temperature changes by 100 or 200% or something, which is what's forecast now, it'll get that much drier, and again it'll be simply impossible for most people to live there. And to provide a contrast to what it used to be like, these are the Inner Mongolian grasslands that I visited, where the grass used to come up to the bellies of horses, they said, in the time of Kublai Khan and all the fabled time when that was the steps of, the huge steps of Asia. And you look across that now and it looks like the Sahara Desert. There isn't a blade of grass to be seen, and as soon as the wind blows, the dust starts rising, and you get these enormous dust storms which go right down onto Beijing, onto all of the other big cities, and even sometimes cross the Pacific and make dust hazes over the US. So even, these local changes can have enormous global impacts.
How are local communities responding in Western Alaska, for example, where there's a significant kind of thawing that you've described, and winters are becoming a lot milder, and making it difficult for people to find their usual subsistence food sources, and so forth. How are people responding to it? And secondly, do they equate the changes with climate change and fossil fuels? Is there an understanding of that? And thirdly, how do they feel about that? If they do, make that connection.
Mm. Well, people adapt where they can adapt, and people are very resourceful, especially when they live close to the land and they depend on the land for their sustenance. And in Alaska, that's quite visible. But there comes a point where people reach the end of their tether, really, and the adaptation options, as they call it, are not very wide. So, if you the people I met in on the western north coast of Alaska, for example, Eskimo people, they depend on walrus, seals, fish, and different kinds of game and other subsistence resources there. Once these begin to disappear, as they are because the sea ice is in full retreat at the moment, and all these animals depend on sea ice to survive themselves, there isn't much that the Alaskan Eskimo people can do to replace those food resources. And I was told by people there that they'd covered literally thousands of miles in boats the year beforehand and had only caught a single walrus, and normally they would have caught tens or dozens or even a hundred or so. And the animal behaviour was changing, they were migrating at the wrong time of the year. Bears didn't know whether to hibernate or wake up. There was ducks on the rivers when the rivers should have been frozen in the middle of January, stuff like that. And really the whole seasonal system, which is the foundation of people's life, certainly for native Alaskans, have been turned upside down. And people who've lived in the same place for hundreds of years and have stories and traditions and whole cultural ways of understanding their local environment, it's very difficult for them to adapt to or even to understand the changes that are going on. And people are having terrible trouble in Alaska. I mean, it's partly cultural as well, probably mostly cultural in fact, but there's a very high level of suicides, alcoholism, this kind of stuff, which is a lot to do with the dispossession of native peoples by the colonists, but also it's made increasingly difficult that their local environment is falling apart around them at the same time. Alaska is a particularly interesting case because it's one of the biggest oil producing states in the US, and in fact when the main oil field Prudhoe Bay was discovered there, it was the largest oil discovery in the Western Hemisphere, so it was enormous, and pretty much all of the Alaskan revenue, for the government revenue, comes from oil industry taxation, and it has a complete stranglehold really over the economy and the politics of the state. And this presents people with a dilemma, because people can see that climate change and global warming are affecting them, and they can see that their weather and the traditions and all of the things that they hold close to their hearts are being affected by this in increasingly severe ways, and yet they know that this, well, I know that the source, I knew that the source of the problem was the oil industry, not just there but across the whole of the world, and the burning of fossil fuels and producing greenhouse gases. When I confronted people in Alaska with this sort of, to me, fairly obvious dichotomy, their response was more often denial than acknowledgement. So people would really say, I've heard about this, but I don't believe it. You know, surely it's somebody else is causing this problem. Temperatures are always changing, and therefore I don't see why we should blame fossil fuels. Or are you trying to undermine our economy? You know, are you from Greenpeace? That was a standard attack. I went up to the oil fields, and people challenged me in the corridors of the hotel and said, are you from Greenpeace? With an obvious threat. And so people really don't want to face up to what's going on. They will increasingly have to, unfortunately, but the same goes for all of us. I mean, I see what's happening in Alaska as symbolic of what's happening everywhere for all of us, that, you know, we all use fossil fuels. I travel around the world on a jet plane. I don't have a car, but a lot of people I know drive around in cars, and I do myself from time to time. All of this is contributing to the problem. We know it's contributing to the problem, and yet we don't seem to be able to alter our lifestyles sufficiently to do anything about it. And so we all have to confront this issue of how we live our lives, not just people in Alaska. It's just that they are almost at the forefront of it.
As Mark points out, ultimately, we're all at risk from climate change, and in a short while, we'll be hearing from Peter Cox, who has studied some of the possible scenarios for what might happen over the next 50 to 100 years if we continue to burn fossil fuels at the current rate. First, however, here's a short piece of music from the Uyghur musicians. The Uyghur musicians, I think you pronounce it, of Xinjiang in China. The Uyghur musicians from Xinjiang with a piece called Mudan Khan from a CD on Globe Style. We heard from scientist David Griggs earlier on about the... Well, he was saying that even the lowest of the predicted rises in temperature for the next century is something that is very likely to be without precedent during at least the last 10,000 years. So we're really starting to enter unknown territory. Like David Griggs, Peter Cox is our next interviewee. He's a carbon cycle modeller from the Met Office's Hadley Centre for Climate Prediction and Research. But he has also been involved in some studies which are currently outside the IPCC consensus, simply because there are not enough people yet, not enough other people yet, who have been involved in similar work, although others are starting now to take an interest. The scenario his modelling predicts is even more dramatic than that offered by the latest IPCC report. Our dilemma is, can we afford to wait to find out whether or not he will be proved right? Here's our conversation.
You've been studying the role of the carbon cycle in global warming. That's probably something we all studied at school, but can you remind us how the carbon cycle works?
Okay, I mean, essentially what happens in the carbon cycle is that on the land, plants absorb carbon dioxide from the air as part of their growth process. And then when you're in a balanced state, what happens is the plants either die or they drop leaves or whatever onto the ground, where it's broken down by organisms in the soil and ultimately return back to the atmosphere. So you've got a closed cycle in the system where carbon dioxide being absorbed by trees and then released by soils. And these two things are normally in balance if things aren't changing the environment.
Over the last 100 years or so, we've been burning a lot of fossil fuels and thereby releasing ancient stores of carbon back into the atmosphere, so there's a lot more carbon in the system now. What is the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now compared to pre-industrial times?
We're about, we've put about 50% on the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so we've gone from about 280 parts per million before we started to emit of CO2 up to about 370, nearly 380 parts per million. So we've added about 50% to the concentration in the atmosphere,
right,
primarily for emitting fossil fuel,
right,
from burning fossil fuels.
Right. And how is that affecting the plant life?
Well, what CO2 does, is one of the things it does is it stimulates plant growth. So because plants are reliant on carbon dioxide to do their growth, if you give them a bit more and other things aren't limiting, so they've got plenty of water and it's not too cold and it's not too hot, then they do tend to grow a bit faster. And what seems to be happening at the moment is that that effect, plus a number of other effects, is increasing the rate at which vegetation, the rate at which the plants are absorbing carbon, such that it's now faster at the moment, faster than the rate at which soils are releasing carbon in the form of carbon dioxide. But as a result, we have a sink for carbon. There's a net amount of our emissions that are actually being absorbed by the land at the moment.
Right. So the plants are happy, and presumably, that's a good thing in terms of global warming, because they act as a buffer almost.
That's right. At the moment, what's happening is that of our emissions of carbon dioxide from fossil fuels and other activities, only about half staying in the atmosphere. And of that half that isn't in the atmosphere, half of that, so about a quarter of the total emissions, is probably going into the ocean, and maybe a quarter is being absorbed by the land. So at the moment, these two natural systems, the land and the ocean, are as you say, slowing down. They're buffering the rate at which climate changes. And so that has actually stalled, well, not stalled, it's reduced the rate at which we've experienced climate change from our emissions.
What about the oceans? What role do they play in all this?
The oceans store an enormous amount of carbon. They store something like 40,000 billion tonnes, which is much larger than the atmosphere, which has got about 750 billion tonnes in them. So a small change in the fractional store in the ocean can have a big impact on the atmosphere. And this may be what happens during ice ages, when the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is much lower. That could be because the oceans have more in them. But under climate change, what you expect to happen is that as the carbon dioxide goes up, carbon dioxide dissolves in seawater, and that's how it's stored in the ocean. And it tends to dissolve in seawater that's colder rather than warmer seawater. It's less soluble in warmer seawater.
Right.
So you get uptake of carbon dioxide by the ocean when you increase the atmospheric concentration, which is what's going on now. But the rate at which that happens may reduce because the temperature effects and the climate change effects on the ocean. But it looks like it's probably a more
reliable way of taking up carbon dioxide at the moment in the over the next 100 years than, say, the land will be.
So far, so good. In terms of the natural systems kind of helping to act as a buffer, in a sense. But your research has thrown up some rather worrying trends for the future. Can you tell us what happens as the Earth continues to heat up?
Yeah, what we've done is to take an existing climate model, and the way climate models normally work is they're like weather forecast models, really, but instead of being run for 10 days, you run them for hundreds of years, and instead of trying to predict individual weather events, you try to predict how the long-term climate will evolve as we increase carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And what we've done that's new is to say, okay, we will include the carbon cycle as an interactive element in this model system. What that means is that as climate changes, the rate at which carbon is absorbed by the ocean and the land will itself be affected by the climate change. So there is a potential for the climate change to affect itself, to feed back on itself by changing the rate at which carbon dioxide changes.
Right.
And what we did was to include these responses of the carbon cycle to climate within our model. And when we ran it forward, we got a very worrying thing, which was that in the model, the land, instead of taking up carbon as now, stops taking up carbon, and worse than that, it starts to release it. And it starts to release it at a rate that's actually quite large, such that we, in the model, we accelerate the rate which carbon dioxide increases over this century. And we reach more like 1,000 parts per million, which is almost four times the pre-industrial level, instead of about 700 parts per million if you don't include this effect.
Right, that's by the end of the century.
By the end of the century, so this is by 2100. Hmm. And essentially two main things happen on the land. One is that the decay processes, the processes in the soil that release carbon dioxide back to the atmosphere, they increase as the temperature goes up. So as you increase the temperature, eventually these processes win the battle between uptake by plants and release by soils, and the soils, therefore, some of the carbon in the soils is released to the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide, which accelerates the greenhouse effect. And the second thing that happens, which is catastrophic locally, is that the climate change that we predict includes a very large drying in the Amazon basin, so large in fact that you can't support the rainforest anymore, and therefore the carbon that's stored in the trees and the soils there again ends up in the atmosphere and accelerates the problem. So it's two main effects, but the overall impact is that our usual assumption that the natural systems will continue to buffer us don't seem to apply in our model anyway for the next 100 years.
So the first thing that happens in your model is that the soil respiration tends to act as a carbon source. Is that correct?
That's right.
And at what point in your model does that happen?
The overall land sink for carbon becomes a source for carbon at about 2050 in the model, under this particular scenario, which is what's called the business as usual scenario. So this is a bit like saying, well, let's assume that economic development carries on as we have done over the last few decades and that we continue to use fossil fuels in the same way. Under those conditions, about 2050, the acceleration begins to happen.
Right. So that's, obviously within the next 50 years.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, then you're saying that beyond that you get the drying out of the forests, like the Amazon rainforest, and more kind of forest fires and stuff, which actually accelerates the rate of...
Actually what happens in the model is that the drying of the Amazon in this model occurs before 2050. The actual timing of the drying is uncertain because of uncertainties about the way process represented and also uncertainties about the rate at which we'll emit fossil fuel CO2. But it happens earlier. The contribution is slightly smaller than the contribution from loss of soil carbon, but obviously it has major ramifications locally in the Amazon basin. If you lose the forest, if it just gets dry, then that whole area is completely transformed.
Mm. So as you were saying, this is a kind of a positive feedback where the system is being pushed progressively away from its normal steady state, and the rate of change in terms of global mean temperatures is accelerating.
That's right. Yeah, so we have a situation where the carbon cycle at the moment is providing a negative feedback. It's suppressing the rate at which we change climate and change CO2. But what this suggests is that you can, these sort of negative feedbacks can switch into positive feedbacks if you cross certain thresholds in the system.
Yep.
And in this case, the threshold is at 2050, or about 550 parts million of CO2, which happens to be about double what we started out at.
Right.
Sorry to admit.
Right. Well, it's an interesting figure, because 550 parts a million is what I understand to be the level at which it's widely being suggested that carbon dioxide levels should be stabilised at, which kind of fits in with your results as well, because obviously beyond that point things start to get unstable, increasingly unstable. And I presume that's what the government's white paper is also based on when they're suggesting a reduction of 60% of carbon dioxide by 2050.
Yeah, I think that figure of 60% reduction is based on this idea that you need to stabilise. Well, in fact, to stabilise at any level, you have to get down to the level where you're just about balancing the amount of carbon that's being taken up by the ocean. Because as soon as you stop increasing the carbon dioxide level, actually the land stops taking up carbon anyway. But you're right that the figure of 550 that we come up with happens to be very close to what others are now saying is the target level. I mean, many believe we should try and stabilise before 550, because some of the effects are continuous from now onwards. But whenever you have a threshold like that Amazon issue, then it's pretty clear that, at least in the context of that model, that there is a dangerous level you can define. And in some ways that's helpful, because it sets a target.
Okay. Was your modelling included in the IPCC's range of possible temperature increases that they included in their last report?
Our results certainly got a mention in Chapter 3 of the IPCC report, although they didn't explicitly feed into the range that was given. So the range of, I think it's something like 1.8 to 5.2 by the end of the century.
That's centigrade increase in temperature.
That's right, yep. By the end of the century, is based on primarily on the fact that we're not sure how the emissions are going to go in the future. I mean, there's so much uncertainty on the socioeconomic development and how technology develops. And then the secondary effect is that we don't know how sensitive the real Earth climate is to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. But there is this additional effect that we're talking about here, which is that there is the possibility of an amplification that comes from the carbon cycle, and some aspects of that are included in that figure, but they certainly don't go as far as the amplification we see in our model. So the range would be larger, I believe, if the full uncertainty in carbon cycle feedbacks was taken account of.
Right. In a sense, your research suggests that some of the models, you know, if they don't take this into account, they're missing quite a significant factor.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think what always happens with these consensus reports like the IPCC is that you have to get to a situation where the sort of critical mass of scientists are prepared to agree to a fact. And even with our results now, there's a lot of uncertainty in it, because as soon as you introduce an additional component like the carbon cycle, then you multiply various uncertainties in different parts of the system. So there's no doubt that it would be very difficult at the moment to get people to agree on a figure, say, for the carbon cycle feedback. All we can do, and this is probably what will happen in the next report, is to say, based on current uncertainties, the real range for possible warming, say, by the end of the century is this, and the upper limit will almost certainly be larger than was quoted previously, unless we can find some other way to constrain some of the other uncertainties. With the carbon cycle, I'm pretty sure that it will extend the upper range quite significantly.
Right. I mean, this may be outside of your area of expertise, but could we just look briefly at some of the other positive feedbacks that some scientists are concerned with, and a few of which are mentioned in passing in the latest IPCC report? The one is the reduction in snow and ice cover and the retreat of the polar caps, which kind of reduces the reflectivity of the Earth and thereby adds to warming.
Yeah.
How significant is that?
Well, I think in some ways the snow ice albedo feedback, as it's called, is the kind of archetypal positive feedback, because it's pretty clear what's going on. So you warm up the system, you warm up the planet as a whole, which means you also warm up the poles and the regions that are cold and snow covered for part of the year, and you obviously melt some of the snow. And if you melt the snow, then instead of having very bright, very reflective surfaces covered in snow, you have much darker surfaces, often maybe trees or grassland or bare soil, and that means you absorb more solar radiation and you warm up the system. And that feedback has been known about for a long time, and it's probably quite critical, for example, in the fact that we, you know, the Earth has suffered glacial interglacial cycles, where this feedback is probably very important in flipping the system from glacial to interglacial and back again. So we're pretty sure it is important in the real system, and all of the models produce quite significant amplifications of the warming from this effect. And this is the reason why, if you look at projections of climate change, there tends to be much larger warming in the high latitudes, particularly in the northern latitudes, where the snow will go, and therefore you'll get an additional effect.
All right. What about the release of carbon from glaciers as they continue to melt? Is that significant?
Well, there isn't any carbon specifically in glaciers, but what you have in the permafrost regions, these sort of regions that have got permanently frozen soil, is two things. One is that during the partial melt of those regions, the microbes there are living in the soil in very wet conditions, and they release methane, which is a very strong greenhouse gas, much stronger than carbon dioxide, in fact. So one of the concerns is that if you warm up the system, you will increase the activity of those microbes, and you might also get deeper layers of thawed permafrost, which would emit methane to the atmosphere. So that would probably increase the amount of natural methane that goes into the atmosphere as we warm the system, and could provide, will provide some kind of positive feedback on the change, will amplify the warming. The second thing that happens in permafrost, and this is also true at the bottom of the oceans, is that beneath permafrost and beneath sediments in the ocean, you can have methane in the form of hydrates, which is basically bound up with water, if you like, as a sort of semi-solid state. And those things, contain a lot of methane, a lot of carbon in the form of methane. At the bottom of the ocean, it's believed that there may be 10,000 billion tons of carbon in that form, which is, you know, more than the fossil fuel reserves we've got left. Under permafrost, it may be 600 billion tons. Again, very big. And the worry is that if you warm up the system, then these things become unstable, or can become unstable. In my view, this is one of the big unknowns with regard to possible rapid change. There's been some evidence in the past that some events, even some extinction events, are associated with what appear to be these pulses of hydrate release, particularly from the ocean. And what we're not clear about yet is the extent to which the warming we're currently subjecting the Earth to could destabilize hydrates and therefore amplify the warming significantly more.
Right. The final one then is the Atlantic Ocean circulation system, known locally as the Gulf Stream. If there's a lot of melt from the polar ice caps, I understand that could lead to a cooling and turn off that system.
Yeah, the Gulf Stream's a really interesting one because it's sort of counterintuitive. I mean, the hypothesis goes like this: you warm up the system through greenhouse gases, you start to melt ice in the far north, which releases fresh water, particularly into the North Atlantic Ocean. And what that does is it suppresses it makes the water lighter because it's less salty, and it suppresses the tendency for the water to sink there. Now, the sinking motion in the North Atlantic is what drives the Gulf Stream, and it's what keeps us warmer than we would be at the same latitude if it wasn't for the Gulf Stream. In fact, a lot warmer than we would be. So one of the hypotheses goes that what could happen is that you will heat up the planet, but strangely, because you shut off the Gulf Stream, we could have a cooling, locally a cooling, say, in Western Europe. And the models also are uncertain about whether this will happen or not, but it's fair to say, I think, that the latest models, including the model we run at the Hadley Centre, at the Met Office in the Hadley Centre, they don't show a tendency for this to happen. You have to hit, in these models, certainly in our model, you have to hit the North Atlantic very hard with a lot of fresh water to stop the Gulf Stream from transporting heat. But nevertheless, if it did happen, probably what it would do is to, locally in Western Europe, would be to certainly reduce the rate at which warming occurs because of greenhouse gases, because you've got these two competing effects. Greenhouse gases are warming up the system, but if the Gulf Stream were to shut down, you would cool the system a lot locally. And you'd probably change rainfall patterns a lot, which is perhaps more important. Again, it's an uncertainty, but it's an interesting thing where the systems like the Earth system, complex nonlinear systems, can behave in almost counterintuitive ways. You hit them with a heating pulse, and yet, strangely, they can locally cool down.
Right, so these are all areas of big uncertainty, really, which we would rather not push the system into because we really don't know.
That's right. I mean, exactly. The key thing here is that we know that from the past records, things like ice core records, we know the Earth system occasionally makes rapid transitions, even when you don't force it. But the confidence we have in our predictions and our projections reduces rapidly as we get further and further away from what has been observed in the past. And the problem is that at the moment we're in what's sometimes called a no-analog state. If we look in the recent history of the Earth, and it isn't that recent, if we look in, say, the last 400,000 years, we've never been at a carbon dioxide concentration at the current level, and the planet has never been as warm as this. So it's very difficult for us to use past measured conditions on Earth to give us any kind of indication of what will happen in the future. And as a result, all of these thresholds are going to be highly uncertain. But the danger is, the risk is that they're more likely to occur, these surprises are more likely to occur if you push the system further and further away from where it's been before, and that's what's going on at the moment. And I guess that's one of the major kind of arguments for being careful about pushing the system too far away from it is, and trying to reduce the extent to which we do that.
Right, so the moral in summary, if you like, is to try and get to grips with the kind of level of fossil fuels that we emit by 2050, so that the system isn't pushed beyond that threshold that we talked about earlier.
That's right. I mean, I think the Framework Convention on Climate Change talks about dangerous levels of interference with the climate system, and we're not quite sure where they are, but we become more and more uncertain about where they are the further we push the system away. So that's a good argument for trying to stabilise carbon dioxide at a level as close as possible to where we are now. And there'll always be a balance between having to make economic, socio-economic changes to do that and actually trying to avoid the risks. And that's the big, in some ways, that's the big issue that's being grappled with now, is where should we be aiming for and how do we get there?
Right, and that's largely being, is largely in the hands of the politicians.
Yes, it is. I mean, yep. I think through things like the Kyoto Protocol, we're attempting to grapple with that, and it is mainly policymakers that are involved in that process. But they take a lot of notice of what's going on in the scientific community, and the IPCC, for example, has a big part to play in trying to provide the right scientific information so the right decisions can be made, really.
Thanks to Peter Cox for that interview, and thanks also to Mark Linus, David Griggs, Chris Weaver and Kay Grant for their help with this show. We're actually working on two more shows in this series. The next is on Thursday the 28th of August, when we'll be looking at the response of central government and local government in the UK to climate change. And the final show is on Thursday the 25th of September, when we'll be looking at what we can do as individuals to help mitigate climate change. If you want to find out more about the science of climate change, the first place to go would be the IPCC's website. The IPCC, as we talked about earlier, is the world's most authoritative body on which collects the existing research on climate change, and it's reviewed by all the leading scientists in the world. And they publish reports on an interim kind of basis. Their website is www.ipcc.ch. And we have a little time to play with at the end of the show. So we're going to play out with a piece of music by Holger Tschukai and Rolf Damers called Kinaxis. And the show following this will be called Mebius Strip.
Resonance FM 104.4.